If you're looking for the skills and tools to succeed in real estate investing, you've come to the right place. This show is about breaking through barriers, breaking through limiting beliefs, and breaking through to the life that you want to live through the power of real estate investing. You're listening to the Breakthrough Real Estate Investing Podcast. And now, here are your hosts, Rob Brake and Quentin D'Souza.
Welcome back, everybody. Thanks for joining us again. And happy to see you here again with us, Quentin. Excited to talk to you.
Nice to see you, Rob. You're looking great, you know, well tanned from your Costa Rican sun.
You know what's really annoying is when I do go out and get a tan, it looks good for like the first couple of days. But you see how there's no hair up here?
Yeah.
that tends to burn really fast. And then this is the result. You can see like it's all patchy and weird looking up there at some points.
You see this? I was born like this. So I was born tanned. Makes it easy.
Yeah, exactly. You don't even need to go outside. You can just spend your whole day and night indoors.
I just born that way. It works for some things.
Well, glad to have you back here, Quentin.
Oh, thanks. You know, lots going on. Just trying to get things done. You know, as always, always working through different items and trying to, you know, make sure that my business continues to grow and, you know, working on different projects.
And always inspiring people at the Durham REI every month.
Thank you. Yeah.
What is that? That's the first Wednesday of every month.
Yeah, first Wednesday of every month. We've got a cool one. We've got some, I don't know if you remember Drew Knox.
Of course.
Yeah, so Drew's doing, he's been getting into Airbnb arbitrage. And in different countries. So he's going to be sharing that at the meeting. And we have a couple of others speakers as well. So it should be fun, as always.
Very cool. Yep. And looking forward to that. And even if somebody can't drive out there, they can still join and they can get all the content online.
Yeah.
So you don't have to be in the area.
No, we have members. We have members in Costa Rica, in Mexico, and actually we have different provinces as well, because you can watch it streamed, and then we do Q&A. I do a Q&A once a month, and people can ask me whatever questions they want. So they have an experienced investor. It works out pretty well. We have lots of fun too when we do that. In the summer, we end up doing some networking events. So we do like a boat cruise or things like that. It's fun.
Awesome. I want to remind everybody, and we have a little contest going on, but I want to remind everybody to go over to iTunes and rate and review the show. And right now, if you go over and just tell us what you think, honest opinions, you know, it doesn't have to be all fluff for us. Honest opinions of what you think of the show and maybe where we can improve, guests you want to see on it. But tell us what you think. And we've got a little contest here. I think on the next show, we'll probably announce the winner on the next show, but Quentin's going to give away three of his books.
Yeah.
And you can pick whichever ones you want, as long as you go over there and write a review. And if you're the one picked, you get to choose out of what you got, six books, right?
Yeah, I've written six books, so they can pick three and I'll send it out to you, and we'll get you all set up. So we'll pick somebody at random so that they can win from the reviews.
Yeah, I guess I'll take the names of the people that have went in and we'll just pull them out of the hat, and that'll be the winner.
Yeah.
Okay, so go over and write us a review. We've almost got 400 reviews, and we got like a 4.8 or something like that out of 5 rating. So that's really good. And we just want to get more people aware of the show, because there's people, believe it or not, just discovering real estate investing right now. This might be the first show that they listen to. So we want to continue to add content and continue to get this show out there to people who are just starting, or maybe want to learn some more from experienced people like our guests that we have on today.
Yeah.
And many of the other guests that we've talked to in the past. So that, as well as go over to the website, breakthroughreipodcast.ca. We've got our free gift on there that they can get. And you can, you know, see the show notes and the contact for all of our past guests over there.
Yeah, Absolutely. You know, we have some great conversations here, and you know, I we're both in the trenches. I'm in the trenches every day. I was talking to one of my friends who has a large portfolio, and one of his properties burned down, and I had an issue probably 5 or 6 years ago where I had a property burned down, and I was talking to him about the strategy that I used. You know, when I actually hired an independent fire adjuster, and actually scaled their compensation based on how much they got us above what I thought they could get us. So I kind of structured it differently. So things like that. I do this every day in and out. So I've got lots of great insights of what's happening in the market right now, including the JT Bill of Rights. What the tenant Bill of Rights? Here we go. So
I
I
was
don't
going to
know.
ask your opinion on this,
Oh
what you
man.
think.
Well, I guess what's happened is he's actually following through on something that he announced in his, you know, when he his platform in the last election, right? So he mentioned that component of it in his last platform, and I think that there are pieces of it that I think make sense, like, but we're already doing in some way, shape, or form. Like, you
And
can't.
depending on which province you're in, though, right?
Yes,
So that, yeah.
absolutely. Yeah. So like in
So is this
Ontario,
going
you
to
can.
supersede the provincial guidelines?
I mean, that's the question to try to figure out. You know, some of the pieces that he's talking about with, being able to see, you know, people's rents, what they were before they rented it, before they rented it, what the rent was, labeling, you know, on their credit bureau whether they paid rent or not. How about if they don't pay rent? We make sure that that happens too. The other thing too, and this is just my opinion. I don't like any politician, especially career politicians. I'm not favorable of any of them. But what I find is that it seems that private rights are being eroded. Private ownership rights in Canada are being eroded by each of these governments that we're seeing. They're eroding the rights of property owners in various different ways. And I think that's wrong. And I don't think that that's what we elected a government to do. So regardless of what you're thinking about, whether it's a tenant's Bill of Rights or something else, you know, I think our ownership rights are this is a problem, especially for any government to affect ownership rights. So that's just my kind of take on it.
And then what's this? You just put this chart in the chat. What is this?
That's something I was sharing. Carl Gomez is one of the economists. I follow a number of different economists, and Carl Gomez was sharing this statistics of Canada's standard of living since 2015, and compared to the US, our standard of living has declined significantly as compared to what has been happening in the US. And oftentimes, you know, the way that this is expressed is when you travel. So just say, like, you travel, not only, you know, cost of goods and food and all of that, but like, if you think about it, think about you if you travel to Florida or Costa Rica or someplace like that, and you go to spend your Canadian dollars, it really doesn't go as far. Right? It really doesn't get what you were getting before. And if you just look back 10 years ago, I can relate to that. Directly, you know, with some of the travels that I've done. So I think that, you know, over the last 10 years, we've seen a deterioration of Canada's standard of living. And that's something that we need to work on, not only, you know, this government, but future governments to be able to change that direction. And so that's, anyways, that's just
Yeah, it
my
looks like a
two
pretty
cents.
harsh decline in the last couple of years, really.
Yeah,
Right?
absolutely.
Like a
Yep.
build up sort of from the bottom of COVID or whatever you want to call it, the height. It goes back up, you know, pretty decent, but then over the last couple of years, we're just diving down.
Yeah, I think what I like to do is always compare to what, like when I'm doing something, compared to what. And I like to compare our standard of living to what I would consider the US standard of living. And that's a clear cut example of how it's not going in the direction that we want to see it go. So I don't know, a little discussion point, something to start off with. We'll put it in the show notes so people can see it.
Yeah, and also we'll get the link for the for that tenant bill of rights.
Absolutely.
And put it in there so people that don't know can see it. Okay. Anything else you want to talk about?
Oh, I've got lots of things to talk about, but let's talk to Aaron. Aaron is a co-founder of the Finley Mortgage Team and CMHE correspondent since 2020. Aaron and company have pushed the boundaries of the multifamily space, allowing for institutional level products to be more accessible for the average investor. Aaron's understanding of debt structuring provides investors an ease of moving it between capital stacks. Having worked with independent investors to REITs, he has a full understanding of the complexity of different structures and nuances that come with real estate investing.
Very cool. Welcome to the show, Aaron.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, you nailed it. Yeah, it's a pleasure. Pleasure to be on with you guys.
I appreciate you taking the time. I'm sure we're going to learn a lot. And so let's go. One of the things that I wanted to focus on a little bit is just like learning about the person, not just their job, right? So tell us a bit about yourself.
And the beautiful stash that you have there, man.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's changed. Like it changes over the course of the year. You know, sometimes like winter weather, summer weather, depending on what's, you know, most comfortable.
It's
so
like, yeah, you need to, it's like, you know, when you... I'm not going to say what I was going to say. It sounds too stupid. But in the summer, you'll wear it a little shorter. Is that the idea?
Yeah. Okay. It's, I mean, honestly, it's kind of just a spur of the moment thing. Sometimes you look in the mirror, you just get sick of it and you trim it all off. And then it just, you know, it grows back out till you feel like you're sick of it again. So I've had it out curling and I've had it short down to the stub. So it's wide range of different appearances.
So tell us a little bit about your real estate experiences, your investing, your...
Wait a minute, Quentin. The stash doesn't like sum him up as a person. Let him talk a little bit about what he likes to do, you know, family, friends, interests, that kind of stuff.
I mean, you know, building the company over the last 4 years, I think has been... you know, like a huge time consumption for myself and like business partner Josh as well. You know, it's kind of like a cliche, but no one really, or it's really impossible to grasp what goes into building a business and a company without actually doing it, right? You know, you can listen to the podcast and read the books and hear the firsthand experiences, but until you really dive in and you're in it on the day to day and in the nitty gritty, like it's, you don't really understand how much time goes into it, how much of your capital goes into the company. You know, hiring assistants, staff, support staff, everything like that. The rent, the expenses, the overhead, everything, right? You really do have to kind of like stick yourself into the fire and you know, just kind of understand what goes into it. So that's been a huge learning experience for us over the last 4 years. And that's taken up, you know, basically 90% of our time. And it's something that we love to do. And we've had, you know, like the ups and downs doing it, but like overall, it's been a blast. You know, we started it in 2020. That's when the Finley Mortgage Team became its own dependent brokerage. Not a bad time to kind of get into the, you know, into the market as the brokerage. So we kind of, you know, we were tossed into the fire of that hot free money era for the 2 years there. And then we, you know, quickly got into the opposite end of the expensive money and the market changing after COVID and interest rates rising and, you know, 30-40% depreciation and housing prices. So, you know, within 4 years, we've kind of seen the two extremes of the markets and, you know, we've been able to help our investors navigate that and just try to, you know, guide them as best as we can with the knowledge that we have. But it's been great. You know, we've met a lot of great people. We've seen a lot of people come from, you know, zero properties to, you know, 100, 200 doors. Life-changing stuff, right? Like the wealth that they've created for themselves and their family. You know, we've seen investors buy, you know, their parents' cars, paying off mortgages for their parents, you know, changing their lifestyle, moving to, or, you know, having secondary homes. And like, you know, Costa Rica is one of the more popular ones that we tend to see, guys moving down to Florida. So it's been pretty crazy to see the the benefit that the investors have been able to get from it. And it really does open your eyes to just the benefits and what real estate is able to bring to individuals.
Very good. Do you have lending options for Costa Rica, or just help people free up their capital in order to be able to come down and do that?
Yeah, we're pretty we're limited within Canada with our license. So there might be private lenders out there who would lend in Costa Rica, but for us to be able to originate and set up the loan has to be within Canada. So we could pull out secondary debt or refinance properties to get access to capital, but in terms of actually structuring the loan, it's all within Canada.
And I would say that's basically what I've got to guide people to do when they come down here, because the lending options here right now are not that great. So when people ask, that's majority of the time we'll need to send them to somebody like you and be able to do your magic on that side and be able to free up the capital for them to come down and invest here.
Yeah. Is it a lot of private BTB loans in Costa Rica?
There is, but I mean, they're all short term, right? So they're like 5-year max kind of thing. And that's not a bad option, but then you've still got to come up with the money, right?
Yeah.
In that time. Yeah. So we do have a lot of vendor take back. So that's good for people who want to who know that they've got money coming to them within the next couple of years to be able to pay it off.
Yeah.
But that has a lot to do with the cycle, right? Like just like real estate has cycles, we have, boom, bust, and then recovery. Lending has a cycle too. Lending goes up and lending gets, there's lots of lending. Then there's, lending gets tight, really tight, harder to get financing, get funds, and then it loosens again, right? So just like real estate has that. And if you're in a place where it's harder to get lending already, then it becomes even more challenging, right? So, those cycles are in lending just like they're in real estate. It just people don't really connect the two often, but I know that it is definitely harder when it comes to borrowing as an investor. And, the type of atmosphere that we have, unfortunately, in Canada is kind of like almost like an anti-investor attitude sometimes. And that's unfortunate, because that's how you're going to get houses built, and it's how you're going to get rental stock. And if you don't invest, if those people don't invest, what are you going to do? Are you going to depend on, somebody like a government to build your housing? I don't know how well that's gone in the past, but it hasn't in North America very well. So,
They're investing $14 million into this tenant bill of rights, right? That's investing into it, yeah. $14 million, isn't that the number? It's $14
million,
right?
Yeah, okay, 14. Okay. Yeah. So that's what I think of that. No, it's not something. I was holding up my bobblehead, Rob. Sorry for the people not on YouTube. Okay, what about lending? How did you get started? Like, was it something that you were interested in before, or?
It was kind of a fluke, to be honest. So I met Josh in university. We lived together there at one of our student houses, and then we ended up working together in an HVAC plumbing wholesale distribution company for a little bit, and then his uncle, our other business partner, he mortgage broker for 17 years, and we were kind of looking for a new career space to get into. And he said, why don't you guys take a look at, the mortgage side of it? And, we shadowed him for a little bit, kind of saw what he did. He was into more of like the private alternate type side and doing some larger commercial stuff. And that's kind of how we got into it. And, for us, when we first got into mortgage lending, we were into like alternate type lending before we really got into the A stuff. We were doing private B type loans, some commercial stuff before we were even really doing work with Scotia. So, we kind of got exposed to that a little bit earlier on. And I think that really helped us, because as the market started to evolve and we saw, this like FOMO arise around real estate, people wanting to get in, not everyone had the capital or the ability to front the money. So to have the experience and the ability to get these creative type loan structuring is done, and you know, the collateral loans, that really put us on the map, I think, with our, you know, our solution based type lending. And we just evolved from there. It's kind of just exploded.
Could you explain, you used a few terms there, and I just want to make sure that we keep this accessible to everybody.
Yeah.
So you used alt lending, you used collateral loans, you said alt B lending. How do you explain that to somebody who's, you know, just getting started, right?
Yeah.
What are those
point.
Terms? Yeah.
Yeah. Cause I know we do a lot of, and there's a lot of guys out there that are in B mortgages, like alternate type mortgages. And when we talk about it to those who aren't as familiar, they automatically assume we're looking at like a private lender, or they aren't bank loans. And these B lenders are regulated lenders. They are bank lenders for some of these cases. You know, you got Equitable, you have Home Trust, that are Schedule One banks that have an alternate type product. So if we're taking a look at residential mortgages, you have your A side, which is your big five banks, and then your monoline lenders, your First Nats, your NCAPs, those guys. Then you have the alternative type lenders where they offer alternate type products, solutions-based type products, business for self guys, net worth products, you know, individuals that are trying to recover from credit scores or bankruptcy, stuff like that. And also for those who might have a high reliance on rental income or a larger portfolio of properties, you know, we're on the A side. Most of these lenders stop you around five, maybe seven properties. On the B side, we can get up to 10. So there's just a little bit more of a wider range of solutions that we can utilize on the B side that are advantageous and still put you in a bank type lender product.
Yeah, and that's that. Just to be clear here, that's on the residential side, not on multifamily commercial, right?
Yeah, so you're one to four unit lending.
Yeah, 1 to 4 unit lending up to 10 with the B, right?
And
when you said, what did you mean by you say collateral charge mortgages? Because not everybody knows what that means, right?
Yeah. So, you know, the biggest use case that we would see is dilapidated properties or conversion projects, something where you need to make the lender feel a little more comfortable with the deal. So if you're picking up a property, you know, let's say you picked up a half gutted or a gutted property, someone was in the middle of doing a renovation, they didn't have the money to complete it. So, you know, for a lender, you know, they definitely see the upside, but for them, the security here is, okay, we have a half gutted property. You know, someone's going to have to come in, be able to do the work. You know, we're okay to do 75% of the budget or loan to value, but you know, we want some additional security. So what they would do is they would register that loan across the subject property and a non-subject property, an additional property that the borrower, the investor has in their portfolio. And what that's going to allow is the lender to reduce the risk on their side. So the goal here is to get the investor their loan to value or their loan to cost. So, you know, if they're looking at $1 million and that's 75%, the lender may not necessarily feel comfortable at 75% on a gutted property. But if we add in a second property and we can overall, with the value and the equity, reduce the lender's loan to value to 60 or 65%, we're able to put the lender at a comfortable loan to value and still give the borrower that 75% no loan that they're looking for. So pretty common type of structuring that's done on these alternative loans, especially for investors that are doing stuff that's, you know, not your typical 1 to 4 type of property, the conversion loans, construction loans, sometimes picking up, you know, apartment buildings that you may not be able to get a traditional type of repositioning loan. If you're going to have vacancies or if the building's already fully vacant and you're going to be doing renovations, sometimes you might have, you know, issues getting the full loan to value. So, you know, again, collateral loans can be a good option. Or if, you know, if you're short down payment, if you're short funds, or maybe you only have, you know, 15% and you're trying to save some of that capital for the renovations, you know, you can and have in the past, definitely more in the past, been able to get up to, you know, 85, 90% loan to value, as long as the overall collateral is there and there's enough additional equity. You know, these equity-based lenders, these hard money lenders, are comfortable doing higher leverage as long as, you know, the structuring is there for them to feel comfortable.
And then most of the time when they're done, whatever the project is, do they come back to you and move it to a different product?
Yeah, and the private lending is all about the exit strategy, right? So if we're looking at repositioning a conversion project, obviously we're going to try to look ahead and figure out, you know, what's the as complete value going to be. If we're going into a conventional loan or CMHC loan, you know, is the equity takeout going to be there? Are we able to get a large enough loan? to take out that private financing, because you know if we can't, there's no point, right? You don't want to be stuck with a collateral loan in a hard money lender situation where you're going to end up in some sort of power of sale type situation, right? So exit strategy is huge. We'll underwrite the numbers ahead of time. We'll make sure everything makes sense, right? And the nice thing about commercial lending is it's really easy to reverse engineer those numbers, right? If you need a loan of $2 million, well, we can estimate what kind of rent you're going to have. And most of the expenses are pretty easy to get, right? You can talk to a tax consultant. You can talk to your insurance guy. If you're doing some sort of MLI select type product, you're going to have an energy audit. It's going to be able to break down your expenses there. So, we can get a pretty accurate number for these. And then, it's simply just the rent that's needed. Does that make sense for the type of unit, right? If you're looking at $2,500 a month and you got bachelor units, well, it's probably not a viable project, right? So it's pretty easy to make sure it works on the back end.
We'll come back to the MLI select and commercial loans. I want to kind of back into that because it's a little bit more complex, and I want to, I just want to make sure that everybody understands the differences, because commercial loans and residential loans are very different when it comes to underwriting. So I want people to understand what the difference is, because oftentimes people feel like they can't do any more based on, the fact that they own so many properties residential, but then commercially things look different. So can you go into a little bit about how that underwriting process works? And when we say commercial, what are we saying?
Yeah. So the standard commercial loan or multifamily more specifically is 5 units and up. Now there are a couple residential lenders out there who will consider 5 to 8 unit properties on a personal name, like standard residential type underwriting. There's only a couple of them, but so for the most part, 5 units and up is considered your commercial multifamily unit type. When we're looking at the underwriting difference, 1 to 4 units is based off of a personal TDSR, total debt service ratio. So they're looking at all of your income, so your personal income plus any rental income, and then all of your debt. So all of your, anything that shows up on your credit bureau, your car loans, your student loans, all your other mortgage debts, your property taxes, your utility costs. It's a ratio of that. And on average, we're looking for somewhere between, I'm the type of lender, somewhere between 42 to 60. So your A residential guys are around 42, 44% debt to income. And then on the B side, we can stretch it up to 60. Sometimes we can go higher if the loan to value is lower. If you're under 65%, there's actually a shocking amount of flexibility with the lenders. You can get those debt ratios quite high if we're mitigating the risk there. So that's essentially how we qualify, the personal residential side. When we move on to the commercial side, the priority flips a little bit. First priority is the subject property, the condition of it, and the debt servicing, right? We want it to be in good shape, and we want, on average, a 1.2 debt servicing ratio. So your net operating income divided by your annual payments, that's going to give you your debt service ratio.
Yeah. So how much, based on, what you see, how much of the value of the, that the underwriting comes from the actual property itself versus the person? Because in residential, 1 to 4 units, it's probably 80% the person, right?
Yeah.
So what would you say, from a commercial multifamily, what it would look like?
I'd say it's almost, you could almost just flip it. 80, 90% is the building itself. And then, you as a borrower just have to have a strong enough covenant to be able to make the lender, feel comfortable. They're not worried about you personally being able to debt service the loan, but they do take a look at your credit bureau, right? So they're going to pull your credit. They're going to take a look at the debts that you have. They are going to take a look at your net worth statement. How liquid are you? What are your asset types? What amount of that is liquid type assets, what amount of that net worth is equity in a property. And they're going to take a look at your tax returns, right? Your T1s. If you're buying in a business, they're going to take a look at the financial statements of the business. And what they're really doing is just trying to get comfortable with the fact of, who you are. If you're absolutely swimming in debt, you got a 500 credit score, you're probably not going to pass the test for these A type lenders, right? That would be a situation where we might have to look at some sort of private option. But, I can say in 4 years, I've had one borrower get declined on a commercial loan. And it was just due to the fact that when they pulled his credit scores and it was in the 500. So, you know, as long as you're bringing in enough income personally to cover the debts that are on your credit bureau, I'd say 90% of the time, 98% of the time, you're fine to get approved for your commercial loan. It helps when you have, you know, a portfolio of properties, or if you have an initial portfolio of properties, that portfolio is debt servicing, right? If you have a strong cash flow on your portfolio, you know, we can use that as well to add that back. And again, that's something that these lenders are going to look at when they see your T1s. They're going to take a look at, you know, possibly the statement of rentals and how they're debt servicing and what you're claiming and if you're claiming rental income. So it's the commercial side is a little bit more of a big picture thing, you know, but first and foremost, it is the asset. And as long as the asset's okay and the debt servicing is there, they just want to make sure, you know, you have a strong enough covenant as a borrower.
And net worth, how much is your, like the net, like, let's say I wanted to get a mortgage on a commercial property that's $10 million, right?
Right.
What type of net worth would I need to bring to the table in order to, for them to even, let's say the property DCRs or debt coverage ratio is 1.2 based on the net operating income, right? Currently in place, right? Without having to reposition anything, we've got a, you know, a debt service ratio of 1.2. What type of net worth do the lenders actually look at from the, you know, that borrower?
Yeah. So on an uninsured non-CMHC loan, there isn't really a set rule for net worth. Honestly, they're probably going to focus more on your liquidity and what does that look like in terms of, you know, are you putting all of your liquid assets into the down payment and the closing costs here, and you know that's kind of it. Or you know, do you have additional savings to be able to put towards any potential repairs? Or you know, if you're buying a building and there is some vacancies, you can't really do that now. But you know, in 2020, 2021, when rates were, you know, 3%, you could buy a building that had a few vacancies, and there wasn't an issue. So you know, if that was the case, you know, maybe they want to make sure that you have some funds to be able to make your monthly payment, and they're not worried about the loss of income on a vacancy. So on the uninsured side, it's really more just, you know, like I've never come into like a specific limit. If you are in a situation where you don't have a huge amount of liquid assets, you know, they might put in an interest reserve. So if you're on a 24-month term or a 3-year term, you know, maybe they collect 6 months or, you know, half the term in interest up front. So it is basically a cash deposit on top of your down payment. And the lender will hold on to that and distribute that over your payments. And that just helps the lender to ensure that they know these payments are going to be made. But there isn't really necessarily a specific requirement on the uninsured, as long as the lender is comfortable with the file. Now, if we're looking at CMHC insured files, there is definitely a restriction. You have that 25% of that loan size. So on, you know, 10 million, you'd have to be able to show 2.5 million in net worth there to be able to make sure that you qualify. They do take a look at equity in your your portfolio. So they will collect an appraisal. It doesn't have to be an updated appraisal. The appraisal can be, you know, appraisal can be 10 years old, as long as the value and the mortgage statement that you provide show that equity position is there. They're fine with that. And they'll take a look at all your liquid assets as well too. So CMHC side, there definitely is a net worth requirement. And it's something that we try to remind guys, you know, not jumping into the MLI Slack too much, but you see a lot of these 5% down conversations happening as, you know, flashy ticket items and Instagram sellers and stuff like that. And, you know, you got to remind yourself, okay, it's not just 5% down. There's going to be your closing costs. You're also going to have the net worth requirement, the, you know, contingency. So it's the CMHC stuff, there is a much larger emphasis put on the net worth.
Okay. So I think if I'm right, Quentin, are you, your point there was more just to say there's something to this. If you can find the right property, right, it's a lot easier to move into like a small multifamily at a certain point, you know, than it is to stay in the residential.
Yeah. Like for me, like I started to move in 2015, like I created a good portfolio of properties under me. I think I had like 20 or 25 1-4 unit properties before I started to kind of flip over to multifamily. Mm-hmm. And then I found, I just discovered multifamily because it's so much different. Like just the evaluation of it is different because like when you're buying a 1 to 4 unit property, the value is based on what's sold beside you. So it's a comparative appraisal. Whereas with multifamily property, it's about the business. It's a business. So if you can drive up the NOI by driving up income and down expenses, you actually drive up the value of the building. And that building that I bought, in 2015 for, $680,000, I can, because I've turned over all six of the units and increased the income and decreased my expenses, I can probably support a $1.4 million mortgage. And it has nothing to do with the fact that a sixplex sold for something or else right beside it, because a bit, two buildings right beside each other built the same year, same everything. One can be worth $1 million more than the other based on the net operating income. So it can be quite a an interesting business. So yeah, I want to encourage people to take a look at multifamily if they feel like they're stuck or and I know I've done a mortgage with Aaron. So Aaron's great at kind of walking through the whole process with commercial mortgages and getting things done. I don't get anything from Aaron, by the way. So other than his great looking at his great mustache, other than that, he's somebody who can help you to learn, and he knows both sides, the residential and the commercial side, which is quite helpful because a lot of times people get like like when you're doing a commercial mortgage, sometimes like when we closed on the like a 30, we did a $33 million, a 202 unit, six unit, a six building portfolio. Our legal fees were like $250,000, right? Like it's not small. And so commercial can get more expensive, but the upsides are often more expensive or better. Like that same portfolio today, we've increased the rents across all of those buildings by $25,000 a month. That's insane when you look at it from a like a comparative. If I were to look at a house in the same area today at the same time, it would actually be worth less than the buildings are. So it's quite interesting.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note too, like, to your point of how you started out in the 1 to 4 space, you don't necessarily have to have a portfolio of smaller properties to get into a commercial property. We do have a lot of investors now that are, they own their primary residence and maybe they own like a duplex, and they're like, residential properties don't make sense right now at these rates. The cash flow isn't there, and I have some money and I want to get into a 5 or an 8 unit. It is possible you can jump right into a smaller multifamily building and make it work. Now there are some requirements depending on the type of financing. If you're going into CMHC, they may want you to have experience, or they may want you to put on, a property manager, and again, the network stuff. But it's not a limiting factor. You don't have to start out building out duplexes and single family homes to get into there. If you have the net worth and you have the liquidity, at least the capital to be able to get in, and a good credit score, you can make that jump right in. And I think we're going to see a lot more of that now with some of the changes that just came out. FSRA, or I guess OSFI, just came out with the loan to income
Oh, four and a half.
restriction.
Yeah.
That's the 4.5 times the income. Now it's up to the lenders. It's not necessarily like a hard stop. It is up to the lenders to determine how much of their lending portfolio they want. But I mean, that's either going to go two ways. Either the lenders are going to continue to just kind of fly on their own and not really, follow regulations. And a lot of them did just get some huge audits, so we might see them crack down on that a little bit more. But
Can you explain it a little bit? Like what is the premise of that restriction for? Now this is 1 to 4 units again, right? So
yeah, 1 to 4, yeah. It's simply just OSFI took a look at everything that just happened over the last 4 years and realized just how leveraged a lot of people were, and a lot of them now too with the interest rate hikes and how fast they were moving. If you had like a static variable, some of these guys had a 70-year amortization on their property, right? Just because of how much that interest was being pushed back. So I think OSFI just wanted to cool the retail investing a little bit, and their job is to make a more safer position for people getting into real estate, right? So they're not looking at it to be an investor's friend. They're looking to try to protect individuals as much as, you know, everyone might disagree with it. So now they're looking at putting that limit on there. So somebody who's making $100,000, you know, you're straight, like a simple LTI loan income calculation at 4.5% or 4.5 times would be a $450,000 mortgage, right? So that would be technically your limit to what OSFI would want you to be at. Now it's up to the lender to determine, okay, you know, this quarter, how many of our loans that we have on our book exceed this 4.5 times limit? And, you know, do we want this investor on our book? Are we comfortable with them being at, you know, 5 times or 6 times or whatever that that multiplier is? And it's up to the lender to make that decision. So, you know, again, like it's going to be a good reminder for everyone to try to create as strong as a package as possible, right? You want to be liquid. Obviously, you want to try to keep your income as high as possible, keep your debts mitigated. It does take into consideration other rental properties. So if you have other income coming in, you can use that to boost your income. But I do think it is going to push some individuals to get more into the commercial space and start taking a look at small commercial loans as well, too, which we can use on, you know, 3 and 4 unit properties as well.
Yeah, I guess the other piece is that that rule doesn't apply to all lenders, right? So you're really looking at Schedule A banks. It just drives up the cost of financing.
Yeah,
it just drives it up and pushes people out.
Right,
which is fine.
Is it?
But if you want more rentals, what are you doing? Like you're actually doing the opposite, right? You're creating less supply in the market overall. And in Ontario, and probably in BC as well, you know, our rental pool is based on majority of it in Vancouver and Toronto is based on condos, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's where a lot of the rental, it doesn't come from purpose built stuff. Well, in the past anyways, it has mostly come from condos. And, you know, if you're stopping people from buying condos, then you're going to restrict the supply of those. And what you're like, I have friends in great places, which is very handy. And I'm talking to people in downtown Toronto who tell me their condo projects are just stopped. Like cranes aren't moving. People aren't doing stuff. Like, are you seeing something similar? I know we didn't talk about that, but like, have you heard something similar, or how do you feel about that?
I think the government needs to understand that there is a large emphasis on the mid-size investor right now to carry the rental units and some of the new build units, right? If you take a look at these large developers, you know, they didn't get to become billion-dollar companies by building on slim margins, right? Like they're not going to be banging out projects in times where they're not really sure where the rates are going, and there's been a lot of flip-flopping, you know. Bonds are up, bonds are down, bonds are up, bonds are down. And that's what it's been like for the last 8 months, right? It's a little bit uncertain. We were supposed to have rate cuts in March. That didn't happen. It's getting pushed. It's getting pushed. It's getting pushed. You know, I think everyone's seeing in the news, right? There's lots of projects that are catching on fire. There's lots of big names that are going bankrupt on their projects, right? So it's from a construction standpoint, it's a tough time right now to get construction financing. So, you know, new development projects, yeah, the big guys are putting them on hold because they're not going to be building when margins are 2.5%. There's too much of a risk for them. You know, how many articles do you see now where the builders are paying the first 6 months of rent, or they're providing rental guarantees, or they're, you know, they're giving away upgrades to the units because they want people to buy them, or they're discounting the units, right? That's kind of the reality of the condo market right now. So, you know, the big guys, they're not going to be putting the gas to the pedal. So I think it's up to the smaller guys. I think these municipal zoning changes are going to be good. I think it kind of creates a little bit of a path of least resistance for these smaller guys that don't have, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. They can go out and they can take properties and convert it into 4-unit properties. And that's going to help put, you know, units on the rental market, which is needed because that's going to relieve pressure from the buyer's market. But I think, you know, I think they need to understand that you got to stop kind of punishing that middle guy, the middle investor, because they're really carrying the brunt of the new builds right now. I you know, they're not in a position where they have, you know, a few hundred million dollars to sit on and they can wait. You know, they're out there trying to grind it out. They're trying to, you know, they're trying to improve their life, but you know, 90% of the investors, they do it because they want to give back to the community, right? I think it's tough to say that all landlords are bad. You know, there's a lot of great landlords, and we deal with a lot of really great investors who really do care about the community. And, you know, just kind of like, you know, kind of relative, but that whole 400 unit scandal that just kind of came up, I think the negative side of that has to do with, obviously, you know, all the expenses and stuff, but I think it also presents a bad, like a bad appearance on landlords as well too, right? It's not just the financial side and the people losing their prom notes and their money. I think it also does add to how difficult it is to be a landlord in Ontario specifically right now, right? When you have a story like this, it's really easy for the tenants to say, well, hey, here we go. You know, these guys own 400 properties, and how many of them are vacant and they're behind on their property taxes and whatever, right? It does add to the stigma, unfortunately. I think that's something that individuals need to be aware of too. And it's great to scale at a really fast pace, but if you're taking on more than you can handle, again, you know, like, are you adding to the investor and the landlord community, or are you kind of adding a negative light to it?
Yeah, I mean, I know the article that you were, there's actually a couple, but like the one that you're referring to with Dylan Suter, yeah. I think, and there was a few others. I mean, I don't know Dylan personally, but
me neither.
You know,
yeah.
But I think that I know of him though, because the community is small enough. But I think what ends up happening, and when I talked to him and I looked at his strategy, really what he's doing, he's using promissory notes and secondary lending for the down payment. And in a market where the property is appreciating, it works out fine. But when the market switches and goes into the opposite direction, that's where you get into trouble. I mean, we don't know either. I mean, all of those projects could still be fine, depending on how early in the process he purchased it. So, I don't know like what all those second lenders got paid. Like maybe they were getting paid 18 or 20%, right? And they were not looking at the underwriting. They were just looking at the, you know, what the return was. And maybe they already got paid about like 60% of what they put in anyways, right? Who knows?
Yeah. And it's not a knock, you know, it's not nothing against him. It's more just, look, we realize the direction things are going, right? I mean, we were talking about the new like Tenant Right Act, like, if we really want to keep the strength for being a landlord in Ontario, you know, we do have to keep in mind the things that we do and the repercussions of the acts, right? And again, I mean, we have, like, I work with investors who use prom notes, and there's nothing against using private capital to scale. It's about doing it responsibly, right? I mean, you owe a right of responsibility to the investor as well too. It is an unsecured investment. You know, there's no point in just taking on 100 different projects. It's, you know, if it poses a risk, you know, banging them out 25 at a time or whatever, you know, taking on smaller ones and making sure they get done. But again, I think, you know, the situation in terms of the amount of new units that we need, both on the rental and on the buyer side, and with that responsibility coming to the midsize investors, I think we have to try to keep the light, you know, as positive as possible on the investor and the landlord side, because that's what's going to give us, you know, the red tape being cut, it's going to allow for less restrictions and a more positive scope on the landlords.
So I wanted to ask you, that's very interesting. It is. And it's like such a deep discussion to get into. You know what I mean? We could probably talk about that for the rest of the time, but we have a couple of more things to get to. We talked a little bit about some of the new challenges for residential lending. Let's switch back to the multifamily side, and let's talk about some of the challenges, because we've really, you know, stressed how good the opportunity can be. So what are some of the challenges though that come along with that multifamily lending?
And I actually want you to explain what a CMHC correspondent is, because not everybody understands that and its benefit, right?
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, to start off, a CMHC correspondent gives us direct access to submit into CMHC directly. So there are other mortgage brokers out there who could go to a lender that is CMHC approved, and the file can go in through that lender and you know, get the COI and come back. For us, for files, where we feel
Sorry,
the
you're going
need,
to have
and
to explain COI because not everybody's going
oh yeah, the
I
certificate of
like that you're
insurance.
doing that.
So
No, because it is important, right? The
I agree.
majority of the people who are going to listen to this are people that, you know, that need it broken down
Yeah,
quite a
for
bit.
Sure. So the process of submitting to CMHC, pretty similar to submitting into a lender. It gets put into an underwriter. The underwriter is the individual who's going to assess the file, take a look at the debt servicing. What type of program are you qualifying with? Is it, you know, the standard CMHC program? Is it the new-ish MLI Select program? You know, they're going to analyze the file and take a look at it and make sure it's going to qualify to get the COI, which is the Certificate of Insurance. So CMHC is not a lender. They insure the file, which allows the lender to put more favorable terms on there. It's pretty similar to CMHC, say again, Genworth on the 1-to-4 unit side. They're insuring the mortgage, but the lenders on the commercial side, we just have CMHC, and what they do is they insure the commercial loan, and that allows us to get, you know, rates right now in the fours compared to, you know, uninsured rates in the high sixes, maybe the sevens, depending on the lender. And it's going to allow you to get extended amortizations, you know, 40, 45, 50 year amortizations instead of your 25, maybe 30 year amortizations on the uninsured side. So yeah, the COI, Certificate of Insurance, we would take that certificate back to the lender. And the lender is going to take a look at that. They're going to build their pricing in and around it. They're going to take a look at the project, make sure the project fits the lender's, you know, scope and their policies as well too. And then they'll decide if they want to lend on it and at what price and cost.
So what might make it so that you wouldn't get the COI?
Yeah, I mean, it could be a variety of things, right? Could be that you don't have enough net worth. Could be that the project, you know, maybe doesn't qualify for some sort of reason. If it's affordable units, you know, I know there's a lot of like mistakes between what's affordable from the median renter income, which is the true way to be able to qualify that, versus market rents. There are some individuals who just think it's based off of the market rent. It is a big difference when we're taking a look at the affordability. It's based off of the median renter income in that area, in that city or, you know, rural area. Could be, I think, net worth, I think was one of them. Could also be, you know, shape of the building, maybe. Maybe the building just isn't in good enough state. CMHC may want some updates to be done. Right now, one of the things that could stop you from being qualified for CMHC is their stability periods right now. So there was some changes that came out last September. A few things. One, the biggest thing being they want you to be with a CMHC lender for 24 months before they'll consider any sort of refinance on a higher value than what was purchased.
CMHC approved lender. So there's an approved lender list across correct. Canada, right?
Yeah. So NHA approved lenders is your typical list of lenders that are approved with CMHC. Now, I mean, there's a few ways that we can look at this. So I guess to kind of keep it simple, if you're purchasing a property and you want to go into CMHC, excuse me, there's a couple things you can do. You can buy the property with an NHA approved lender on a bridge loan, which is just, you know, if you don't have 3-4 months right now to close the property, you can close on it with a bridge loan with the approved lender, you know, 6 weeks, and then they kick that loan into CMHC. And then once they've had time to approve it, you can get refinanced back out into your CMHC term. That's one of the more standard reasons why you would use like a bridge loan and getting into CMHC.
You can use seller financing as well to purchase the property, right?
You
That's
can,
the
yeah.
Only time you can just now get it, let's say it takes CMHC 3 or 4 months or 9 months to underwrite, you know, get the COI, you could use a seller financing or a VTB to bridge the time. And that way you can, you know, wait until CMHC is ready. Whereas mm-hmm. that may not be the case on, you know, a refinance or something like that.
Yeah. On the bridge loans, there are different parameters for those lenders being used. An easy way to kind of get around some of these like non-NHA lenders is simply just putting the file into CMHC before the closing date. So it's a little bit of a workaround that we can use. It's been approved with CMHC. So you know, if you're buying a property and, you know, you have to close on it in maybe like a few weeks, if we can't get a bridge lender to close, we can use a non-approved lender. As long as we get that file into CMHC before the closing date, it is a little bit of a workaround, but it's not the most ideal way to do it, but it is another option. The biggest issue that we're running into with the lenders and the timelines is you want to buy a building, it's under rented. You want to do the rental turnovers, do some, you know, improvements to the building, and then refinance out at that new value. Well, if you haven't been in your loan for 24 months with that NHA approved lender, there's two options. CMHC is either going to say no, come back to us after 24 months, resubmit in, and then we'll consider the new value. Or what they might do is take a look at your purchase price and your loan to cost if you're within 12 months of those renovations being done. So that's,
So in other words, they just drive up the cost of lending.
Yeah. Well, again, so they would take a look at, if you're buying a building for $1 million and, you know, you had 800,000 in renovations, they would take a look at that $1.8 million value versus maybe a $2.5 million, you know, as completed value. Then that's coming out of a renovation project, refinancing within 12 months. So they're taking a look there at a 12-month stability period. Now, if you were outside that 12-month stability period, you know, again, we might be able to make that work depending on the lender on title and how CMHC, you know, the underwriter, and how they take a look at the project and what their thoughts on it are. But yeah, they really have cracked down on the timelines and the stability and the policies. And it has created a lot of issues for guys that bought properties maybe a couple of years ago with a private lender just because it wasn't working, didn't have an NHA lender on for 24 months, went to go refinance in the CMHC and have been declined and told to wait. So it is putting some stress on these mid-size investors because now they're having to hold on to properties for, you know, 2.5, 3 years on these high interest debts. And it's a tough cost for them to carry.
Yeah. And I mean, just like from the perspective of where I was at, you know, I noticed that approval rates were crazy a year ago too. Like when we submitted together, we submitted in April for that building,
yeah,
and we didn't get our funding until February the following year.
Yeah. Files that were submitted in last year took on average 7 to 8 months to close. And the big thing there was they had, they increased their expenses. So their underwriting expenses and their insurance premiums all went up in June. So I think like at that June deadline, they had somewhere between like four or 5,000 applications in and around that time. I think in total, like they had 6,000 to 8,000 applications last year for financing in general. So there was a huge rush for files to get in and approved. And I think just with the rate environment too, CMHC is, you know, for 90% of the projects out there, it's really the only viable option for these guys to be able to exit out of any sort of repositioning financing. So it's been a bit of an overload for CMHC. I think they've since hired 50-ish new underwriters. Turnaround times now are a lot better. You know, we're start to finish 3 to 4 months, depending on the project type. So it is a lot quicker now. But yeah, last year was a bit chaotic.
Yeah, I guess the
Rob, we can't hear you, buddy.
Oh, is that what's going on? All right.
Yeah.
I wanted to get you to explain the difference between a CMHC loan versus one that's not insured with CMHC.
Sure. Yeah. So your standard uninsured commercial financing, you're typically 75% loan to value and usually a 25-year amortization. That's your typical financing structure. Rates right now, I just had it up here. I think we're sitting around, so this is from a credit union, you know, over 5 units right now. A 3-year is 6.8%. A 2-year is, you know, 7.1. 5-year is 6.6. So those are the rates that we're looking at for your uninsured properties right now. The average file that comes in from an uninsured perspective, loan to value qualifying, usually between 50 to 65%. That's kind of where you're limited to. So the biggest issue right now with multifamily investors and a lack of liquidity is that these investors are looking to get every single dollar out, right? They owe money to prom note guys or private investors for the renovations or the down payment, however they got into these projects. So they need all that capital back out to pay back their investors. They want to keep the relationship alive. They want to be able to, you know, have them reinvest in the future projects. Leaving 35, 40% equity in just isn't an option. So that's the biggest issue right now with the structuring on the uninsured side, is it's too expensive, and you know, the loan to value isn't high enough for some of these guys. When we take a look at the CMHC side, there's two products. There's the standard CMHC product, which has been around forever. Your structuring can get up to 85% loan to value, up to a 40-year AM. You have an insurance premium that's on top of that, and that depends on your loan to value. I think right now it gets up to about roughly 6%, depending if you're at like 85% loan to value. I think your insurance premium right now is around 6%, so it's quite high. But it gives you, you know, a higher leverage, and it gives you a longer amortization. So, you know, for individuals out there right now that are looking to, you know, scale or to pay back, you know, their shareholders, not that you can do that specifically with a CMHC loan, but it does give you access to large amounts. They need that higher leverage. The rates are a lot lower right now. So CMHC rates are based off the CMB, the kind of mortgage bond rates. And then plus some sort of pricing. So, you know, right now, if we're taking a look at a 5-year CMB, you know, as of today or this morning, we were 3.76 and the 10-year was 3.93. And you're usually going to have somewhere between, you know, 65 to 1.25 basis points on top of that, depending on the loan size and location. But on average, you know, we're around 4.75% on that interest rate. So, it's much cheaper. You know, we're almost 2% cheaper than what you are on the uninsured side. And then plus the amortization at 40-year AM, it you know, on average, we probably see about $300,000 to $400,000 extra in loan size availability and qualifiable on the insured side. So it's a, you know, it's a huge difference for someone that needs that money back. It's a, you know, it's a game changer. It saves a project.
So I have one more question. Let's just say, how many files come across your desk? You know, in, I don't know, let's say a year. And then how many of those would be not approved by CMHC?
So how many, well, I get you're asking, like for us, like we're not really submitting into if it's not going to work. I'd say the majority of them will work with CMHC. It just depends as to whether or not the numbers actually make sense for the investor, right? If they're not able to get all their capital out, it's not going to make sense for them. The majority of files will work with CMHC. It's the lender themselves that starts to put in some of the stipulations. So if you hear about lenders not lending on certain loan sizes, that's typically a lender thing. Location-wise is a lender thing. CMHC will lend on, you know, they'll insure basically any file, 5 units and up, any location, pretty much any loan size. It just comes down to the lender and whether or not they want to allocate the time and the manpower and the funds to do that loan. The files themselves, I'd say most of them would probably qualify. Again, it just comes down to whether or not the numbers make sense for the investor. Is it a viable project for them?
One thing I wanted to say as well is that people don't really understand this when they go for their first commercial mortgage, but you don't actually lock into your rate until you close, like 5 days mm-hmm. before closing on yeah. the mortgage. So we're starting in April 2023, closing in February, but the rate can go up 2% in that time period. And all of a sudden, you may have got this mortgage now that doesn't make sense at all. And you may not even want to take it after the bridge. So it causes a problem, the disconnect between the time of when you, because like they're like, okay, the CMB is this, you want to lock into the rate or not, right? It's a different process than
it was interesting for us when we first started doing CMHC stuff and how different it was. And last year was a really interesting time period because, you know, where rates were at, you know, March, April, May, when we were submitting in versus 7-8 months later, you know, borrowers were being hit with, hey, you know, you got to buy down your rate by, you know, $100,000, $90,000. Like there were some tough conversations being had with individuals that, you know, the equity you thought you were getting, you know, you're not getting that. And then even to go further, every lender has their different policies. So not every lender allows you to buy down, you know, your policy rate with the equity takeout. Some of these lenders like First National were forcing guys to buy that down with money out of their pocket. So, you know, if you're taking a look at larger loans, you know, $3-4 million, $5 million, some of these larger development loans that went through, you're looking at, you know, guys that were being told to, you know, $500,000, $1 million out of their pocket to buy that rate down to get the policy back into effect, you know, to make sure that they could close on it. So it was a tough period last year. There was a lot of tough phone calls to be had. It makes it a lot easier when your closing period is 3 months, but when you're going through a tough economy and a tough rate time and you have 7-8 months in between, yeah, your project on the end might be a completely different project.
Yeah, it's interesting. I appreciate having CMHC loans because one thing that people don't understand about U.S. financing is you don't see 35-year, 40-year amortizations with insured products at a low rate. That's what makes the numbers work in Canada in general and in Ontario. Without CMHC financing, a lot of these deals wouldn't make sense, wouldn't get done. And, you know, in the U.S., they have a bigger breadth of financing, a lot of different products because, you know, I have property in there and so I understand it, but they don't have CMHC, which when I explain to them what the terms are and the amortization is, they're impressed by the products because that's what makes it work. So, I mean, I gotta appreciate CMHC for that, but I wish there was more competition in the market. I wish Sagent or Canada Guarantee or some of these other, you know, that play in the residential space, they should be allowed, because CMHC is not allowing them, they should be allowed to play in the commercial space because then we have some real competition and then we'll see what, you know, what we can do here, because I think that would be beneficial as well.
Quentin starting a petition right now.
Hey man, there was that auto Vic petition that's been going around too.
Yeah, like I signed that. Like it's gonna do any good. I don't know. I just signed it, but you know, I don't think it's gonna do anything.
Well, you know what? I think it's good that you signed it, and you know, I think that's important that you're moving in the right direction, right? You have to share your opinion because, you know, if you don't vote or you don't share your opinion, how can you complain, right? So
I agree. And I agree. I would love to have more competition in Canada. I mean, you take a look. We got, what, 7, 8 lenders, maybe 10 if you include some of the credit unions in Ontario. You got, what, 4,400 different lenders in the state to different products. Like, it's a completely different experience. Like, it's not the same here in Canada at all.
Yeah. Well, maybe you can tell us a little bit about the, you know, the Findlay mortgage team.
Yeah. So Findlay, you know, we're like, when we first started out, we went to a VTB seminar held by Matt McKeever. We were invited out there. This was 2019, I think it was. And that was really our first exposure into the investing side. You know, we were having conversations with individuals. How many properties do you own? Oh, you know, I got 50 doors. Oh, I got 100 doors. I got 200 doors. And, you know, Josh and I walked away from that conversation, from that seminar. And, you know, we were kind of mind blown. You know, we were, you know, hey, these aren't homeowners that are doing, you know, 2 or 3 transactions over 10 years. These are guys that are buying, you know, multiple buildings and transactions, you know, per year. So, you know, we started to look into some education, tried to find some YouTube videos and stuff like that. And we didn't really find a whole lot of content out there that was really geared towards Canada, at least. There's a lot of US stuff, bigger pockets, but you know, they got different programs in there. So, you know, it didn't really apply. So for us, that was our opportunity to kind of jump into the content game. And, you know, we've always been about kind of education upfront. You know, like we have, I don't know, a few hundred videos out there across our Instagram and YouTube channels and stuff like that, Facebook. And you know, we disclose as much as we can as to you know, how things work. We've sat down in fully underwritten files. We talked about how lenders look at everything, how things are priced. Like, you know, we don't really hold back on anything. And for us, it's, you know, we just try to give enough value to our clients. And you know, if you get value and you want to work with us, then that's a bonus for us, right? So, you know, carrying on from that, it's been trying to bring these big name products to the middle investors. You know, for the guys that were buying properties in 2020 and 2021, especially on the multifamily side, that were doing the repositioning, If they didn't have access to CMHC, they'd be, you know, they'd be defaulting. They'd be trying to sell their property. They would have lost money on it. You know, these CMHC products have really saved them. And not everyone is in, you know, a $4 million building, $5 million building, right? There's a lot of these guys that are buying, you know, sixplexes in, you know, rural Alberta or Edmonton areas where it's, you know, it's only worth, you know, $1.2 million and your loan size is under $1 million. And you have lenders like First Nat where, you know, they don't want to deal with these smaller loan sizes. They don't want to deal with the 800, the 700, the $900 loan sizes. It's just not worth it to them. And I understand that, you know, I understand if you're Canada's biggest CMHC lender and you're dealing with, you know, big developers, it's an allotment of time and manpower. So, you know, for us, we wanted to bring these institutional products and help the mid-sized guys have access to the same products and the same opportunities that the large scale investors have. And, you know, if that's going to help them save their equity and get out of a project and at least be breaking even on an apartment building or just making a little bit of money, you know, it saves them from losing out. So, you know, it's been great for us to be able to watch, you know, our investors grow from building a smaller portfolio of 1 to 4 units, 5, 6, 7, 8 properties, and then realize it's not for them anymore and start to scale into the multifamily side and, you know, helping individuals buy their first apartment building and, you know, start to scale. And, you know, we've had guys buy, you know, 200, 300 units in a year. And, you know, it's been pretty crazy to watch, to be honest. You know, from someone who didn't really come from real estate before I got into the mortgage side of it, it's been pretty wild to see how successful some of these guys can be. And the stories that we hear from some of our investors, you know, guys starting from nothing, starting from, you know, bankruptcies or bad divorces or whatever, just bad positions and are able to recreate their life. That's been crazy. And, you know, we love what we do. And, you know, we're going to continue with that. We're evolving the company, I guess you can say, and we're trying to open up the scale and, you know, we can help pretty much anyone across Canada where we have access to basically all the provinces. So we have a pretty wide scope and, yeah, you know, we're just looking to make capital more accessible, right. And the education more accessible and just able to teach, you know, investors the products that are out there and you know, how these things work. And, you know, even for us, like, talking to some of these larger scale investors, guys that are worth, you know, 30, 40, 50 million, you know, they're not even aware of some of the CMHC products that are out there. Right. And, you know, we've been able to talk to some of the mid-level developer guys and, you know, say, hey, are you guys aware of like these other construction opportunities and development opportunities with cheaper rates and loan to cost? And some of them aren't aware of that. So, you know, if we can help them put more units, you know, in the market and make things easier and cheaper for them to build, then, you know, like that's what we get as a win in our books is just helping people have more access to the products and the education.
Yeah, you guys have built something really good. And people that have like heard what you have to say here on the show and want to reach out and hopefully you can help them, how would they go about getting in touch with you?
Yeah, so the Finley Mortgage team has an Instagram page. I think it's FMT or Finley Mortgage team. You know, that's monitored by both Josh and myself and our social media team. So I'd say that's probably the most common way that investors reach out to us. You know, I got my own social media page, Lakehawk 22, and then I have my like multifamily mortgages page as well too. That's a little more real estate specific. And I don't know, I think I'm assuming my personal stuff will be in some of the descriptions and stuff like that here. So, you know, my phone number and email will be in there, but, yeah, there's a few different ways that, that investors can reach out to us and, you know, on our website, there's a phone number as well too, that they can call into if they need to. So.
And what's the website?
It's under construction right now. We're redoing it. So, okay. I'll let you guys know when it's back up.
It'll be in the show notes. Along with everything else that Aaron just said.
Yeah.
Man, we've learned a lot. I really appreciate you coming on today. Enjoyed it. And I know that everyone else will have gotten a lot of good information from it. So thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate you guys having me on.
Yeah, I really loved it. Thanks, Aaron.
Yeah, it's been good.
And Quentin, if people want to get in touch with you, which I'm sure they will, how would they do that?
You can find me on Instagram at QmanREI is a way to get it. Or if you want, go to DurhamREI.com or QuentinDeSouza.com, either one of those, depending on what you're interested in.
Okay. People can reach out to me at rob@mrbreakthrough.ca. Thanks for listening, everybody. See you next time.